And welcome to The Third Degree. I'm Jess.
And I'm Nick. This week on The Third Degree, we hear about Rising Tide's Newcastle meeting with Kevin Rudd and look at a study that has found people who are more environmentally conscious are actually the biggest polluters. And the burning issue is, of course, Garneau.
But first, joining us today is Bev Smiles, longtime anti-coal campaigner based in Mudgee. He's in Sydney this week for the Climate Emergency Actions.
Hello, Jess.
Can you tell us, firstly, why people have spent the last week sandbagging Martin Place and Circular Quay, and why you have travelled 6 hours to join them?
I think we're really highlighting the problem that we have both with climate change and the fact that Australia is the largest producer of coal, and the coal industry is having an obvious impact in the decision making that, well, we knew they were seriously influencing the Howard government. It looks like the Rudd government's in fairly the same position. And the community is really concerned about the way decisions are going with the issues relating to mitigating and preventing the out-of-control climate change that we're currently facing.
These protests this week have been targeting coal, and you've spent the last sort of 2 decades as an anti-coal campaigner. What's happening in the New South Wales coal industry at the moment? And what specific areas have communities sort of rallying against coal mines?
Well, we've got the New South Wales government handing out new exploration licences like lollies to the big multinationals such as BHP, Billiton and Xstrata. Rio Tinto are the key big players. And these new coal exploration licences are in new areas. So the big production at the moment is concentrated in the Hunter Valley, mainly between Singleton and Muswellbrook. But the new approvals and exploration licences are moving further up the valley and into the Gunnedah Basin. So we're now seeing good prime agricultural food producing land and farming communities being impacted by a major expansion in the coal industry.
Has this made it more difficult to organise against?
Well, actually, it's the other way around now. I mean, the people that are living in the Hunter where all these big open cut and underground mines are have been impacted for a long period of time, and a lot of them have been bought out and the communities have been fractured. Whereas now, where the new exploration licences and mining expansion is being proposed is in very tight-knit farming community areas who are not going to take this lying down. So we have the farming community up in the Gunnedah Basin in the Caroona area really putting up a major fight at the moment at the exploration stage, and that's the first time that's actually happened at that level. The issue of the impact of mining and water has galvanised people from all the coalfields. So we've got the southern coalfields is around the Illawarra Wollongong area, there's the Hunter coalfields and the Newcastle coalfields, and there's the western coalfields, which the mines near Mudgee and Lithgow are in, and now we've got the Gunnedah Basin, and it's really what's highlighting most people's concern is the impact and the loss of good clean water supply from the coal mining operations and the poor regulation and the poor studies that are being done in the first place.
And what particular campaigns have you been organising around?
I live on a river, and the existing mine on the top of that river's been there since the mid-80s, and I first engaged in looking at what was happening with the coal mining industry because of the impacts I could see on the river that I was living on. So that sort of got me interested in knowing how the government was actually regulating the industry. It's not just the water issues, it's health issues as well, because the open cut mines produce an amazingly large amount of dust, and a lot of that has coal. It's coal dust, which is extremely bad for your health. And there's also the noise in quiet rural areas. We've got new mines moving in and 24-hour operations with a large number of very heavy machinery working. Xstrata currently owns or has part ownership of at least 10 mines in the Hunter Valley. And Amble Hill, which is the big mine that everyone knows about, Xstrata bought that project once it was approved, and they've changed the name of it. It's now Mangoola, hoping to deflect the widespread knowledge of that mine. That's a mine that has been given approval to produce 10 million tonnes of coal a year. And the mine near me, the Yulin mine, has approval for 10 million tonnes, and Xstrata is currently working on a development application to double that to 20 million tonnes a year. So while we're all extremely concerned about climate change and what's happening with government regulation, we have the state government and the federal government allowing a massive expansion of coal mining.
So considering all of this stuff going on, you've been campaigning for a long time, so have you noticed anything sort of notably different about the sort of anti-coal campaigns that are going on today compared to what you may have seen going back 20 years or so?
Oh, definitely. Originally it was mine by mine, and just the local people affected by the mine were the main people trying to negotiate with government and bureaucrats in the planning department and with the mineral resources. But now there's coalitions of people, there's groupings of people, there's a lot more media happening around the fact that people aren't happy about this major expansion. And at the same time, we've had the growing understanding and concern about climate change, and now we're connecting those dots.
I was going to say, if not coal, obviously, what future approach would you like to see Australia take in relation to energy? And what exactly is your vision of a sustainable future?
Well, one of the things the Mudgee District Environment Group has done, because we've been fighting this, the rapid expansion of the coal industry in the States happening on our doorstep, we've done some research into other power options and looked at solar thermal power stations, and we've actually now got a project up that could be funded for a 50 megawatt solar thermal power station in Mudgee that would power 30,000 houses from Mudgee up to Coonabarabran. We have a company, interestingly enough, it's a German company that's just established their a head office here in Sydney, are looking at renewable energy options in New South Wales, and they're seriously looking at this thermal power station that, as a group, we wanted to put up in our area an example of what could be happening in our community other than coal mining, and to show that the lights will not go out, which is generally the argument used. If we don't have coal-fired power stations and we don't have coal mines, then we'll be living in the cold in the dark.
And just for the details of the Climate Emergency Renewables Now action this afternoon, it's outside the office of Xstrata Coal in Sydney, which is at 1 Macquarie Place in the CBD, and that's at 5 o'clock this afternoon. So it's a rally calling for 100% electricity from renewables within 10 years. It's calling for keeping power in public hands, the phasing out of coal, the expansion of public transport, and for no carbon trading loopholes.
And now to this week's burning issue. The federal government's chief climate advisor, Professor Ross Garnaut, submitted his final report to Kevin Rudd on Tuesday. Earlier this month, Garnaut's draft report recommended a 10% carbon emissions cut by 2020, angering climate scientists and campaigners. Now he says he's more open to a 25% emissions cut. The Third Degree's Michelle Watts reports.
The final Garnaut report was commissioned by the federal government as a way to address climate change. The report, like the previous reports, painted two different carbon reduction targets. The first, tougher target, outlined ways of maintaining atmospheric carbon levels at 450 parts per billion. The second, softer option, looked at what would need to be done in order to stabilise atmospheric carbon levels at 550 parts per million. Greens leader Bob Brown argues that the push for the 450 model in the final report was not as strong as it should have been.
He's made it clear that both the options are viable. We should aim at the first, but he'd be quite understanding if we go for the second. He should be saying the weaker option is not acceptable, because he does say that if you take the weaker option, We'll lose the Great Barrier Reef. We're going to lose Ningaloo and Kakadu. And the world's going to warm up.
Anna Rose, Get Up Climate Campaigner, says Australia will be one of the countries that is hit hardest by climate change. She says Ngannou has given up on the fact that the world can solve climate change to levels that will save our Great Barrier Reef.
I think it's really irresponsible of Ngannou to say, well, maybe we can't get there, so we shouldn't try, whereas Australia is the country that really should be leading and trying the hardest to get a strong global deal. And if we go out there to the UN climate negotiations this year in Poznan in Poland in December and say the world should only aim for 550 parts per million carbon levels, I mean, we're going to be laughed at, because that's not a safe level for climate change. That gets us way above 2 degrees Celsius, which is generally regarded by scientists as the dangerous tipping point.
CSIRO researcher Roger Jones was one of the 16 scientists who wrote and signed a letter to Kevin Rudd, reinstating the scientific case for choosing a level of 450 over 550.
I thought the various cases between the choices you might make between 450 and 550 were much more even-handed in this review. So on the one hand, if you focus on dangerous climate change and unavoidable or unacceptable outcomes, you'd be more likely to go for a 450. If you're looking at what might be doable in terms of international agreements or what seems doable at the moment, you might choose to go for a 550.
Do you think Ngannou was still in favour of the more conservative cut?
No, I think he'd rather see a 450, if he thought that it was possible to put international agreements in place. But I think from the economic point of view, he was also saying that a country would suffer a penalty if it chose a 450 target and the rest of the world didn't comply with that.
Today, more than 300 people gathered in Sydney's Bradfield Park, creating a human solar panel. Get Up campaigner Anna Rose was one of the organisers behind the event.
Well, we've got people holding up panels in a kind of diagonal trend, and it looks like a really, really large solar panel. It's a message. It's a strong message to our Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, that, look, today there's a huge economic crisis in the world. There's also a huge climate crisis. And we know that the future of Australia and of the world must be renewable in order to solve both these crises. And the winners of the new global economy will be the countries that restructure their economies first around green jobs, around renewable energy, around investment in green technology.
CSIRO researcher Roger Jones says there are many more environmental risks if the federal government chooses to reduce carbon emissions by 10%.
I think if the world went to a 550 instead of a 450, so all countries did that, we would, you know, the chances of getting 3 degrees warming would be much higher. With that amount of warming, I think we could see, be likely to see substantial ice melt and sea level rise. I think we would see serious damage to sensitive ecosystems like coral reefs.
And that's Michelle Watts speaking with Roger Jones, Principal Research Scientist of the CSIRO. And Bev Smiles from the Mudgee District Environment Group is still with us. And Bev, what's your take on all this?
Well, I find it's very interesting following the detail of what degree of damage we're going to be prepared to accept, which I think for future generations is entirely irresponsible. It's really scary in the context that where I live, we have coal companies planning to double their production, and really that's what needs to be focused on. We need to get off the coal train and get on to funding other sources of energy.
And all this talk over the last few days of 450 parts per million or 550 parts per million, and whether it's 2 degrees or 3 degrees rising, well, this is where our name comes from. This is the third degree that we're talking about. Thanks for coming on the show, Bev. You've been listening to Bev Smiles from the Mudgee
District Environment.
The Mudgee District Environment Group. A community cabinet session was held in Newcastle this week, giving the locals a chance to voice concerns to the federal government. A few people had short meetings with Kevin Rudd and the Minister for Climate Change, Penny Wong. The third degree's James Hitchcock spoke with Georgina Woods from Rising Tide Newcastle about her meeting with the Prime Minister.
The federal cabinet has been holding what's called community cabinet meetings around the country. I think they've held about five of them so far. And yesterday they held one in Newcastle. So they had a cabinet meeting in Newcastle and then they held a public forum and members of the community had the opportunity to meet with cabinet members for 10 minutes and sort of present their issue that they were concerned about.
You met with Kevin Rudd yesterday. Can you tell us about that meeting? What did Kevin have to say for himself?
Well, we asked for a meeting with the Prime Minister and we were successful in getting a meeting and that was really good that they were willing to meet with us. We wanted to talk to him about climate change and our dependence on coal as an export commodity and for power generation here in the Hunter and New South Wales and across Australia. We're really concerned that the federal government isn't acting quickly enough because of the developing climate change crisis. We have a very small window of opportunity to start strategising to wean ourselves off dependence on coal and other emissions-intensive industries. So we wanted to talk to him about that and our fear that if we don't act more quickly and more decisively than we are currently, we're going to lose the Great Barrier Reef and perhaps a third or a half of all of the species on Earth will be committed to extinction.
And what did he say when you mentioned, I guess, things like the Great Barrier Reef to him? Were those things kind of taken on board by him or was it kind of the response you might expect from a politician like you see on TV, a bit more spin and avoiding the question?
To be honest, I didn't think that he was really engaged in what we were saying. Mm. He's obviously very committed to investing large amounts of public funding in carbon capture and storage technology. And we made the case to him that if carbon capture and storage technology were available now to begin reducing greenhouse emissions, then we would be all for it. But the time to reduce emissions is now, and that technology isn't going to be online for another decade or more. And investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of public money in it while we still are increasing our greenhouse gas emissions in the meantime is, a terrible blunder and a waste not only of money but of our beautiful environment that we're sending into climate chaos.
Now, Newcastle has seen a lot of, I guess, protest activity over the last few years. There's been obviously a lot of strong community opposition to the coal industry and to climate change in Newcastle. Perhaps some of us would remember the Camp Climate Action earlier this year with over 1,000 people there protesting against coal. Was there much of, I guess, a recognition on behalf of Kevin Rudd or Penny Wong or any of the government of the people's concerns in Newcastle?
I didn't feel like there was that much acknowledgement that the community actually has much stronger aspirations for climate action and for moving away from coal than the government is currently delivering. I think that they are quite out of step with what people are asking for. There is a broad movement, as you say, of people who are really becoming very frustrated and very anxious about our failure to act decisively to reduce greenhouse pollution. I was actually quite pleasantly surprised by the member for Newcastle, Sharon Grierson, who did make reference to, you know, the very strong and active community here in Newcastle who have very clear views about our future and the way that we want our region to change. And she spoke specifically about coal as something that we have been quite dependent on, but something that people, you know, that people were talking a lot about. But as for the federal government, you know, the cabinet, we didn't feel as if that they really took the cue that we were offering them and took the opportunity that the public is offering them to really make decisive actions and take the quite radical steps that are required.
And that was Georgina Woods from Rising Tide Newcastle speaking with the Third Degree's James Hitchcock.
Recent research in the UK has found people who feel that they lead the most sustainable lifestyles are actually causing the most environmental damage. According to a survey of 200 people done by Exeter University, people who regularly recycle and save energy at home are also the most likely to take frequent long-distance flights. The researchers said that this has been one of the first attempts to examine how green intentions play out in different contexts. Dr. Phil McManus is a senior lecturer at the University of Sydney Geography Department. He has been doing related research into the tensions between discourses of sustainable cities and the practices of neoliberalism. He spoke with the Third Degree's Libby King.
It makes sense. In some ways, it's not that surprising. High-income groups, on the whole, tend to have greater impacts in terms of their consumption. And the other thing about it is some of the high-income groups in some of the inner Sydney suburbs tended to go for the green vote. So I think there's a very strong ecological awareness in the inner-city green votes, and perhaps not surprising that these two things do come together in this particular study. I think it's about education, particular types of education. Those people in high-paying occupations or with wealth accumulated can afford to have greater impact on the planet just by their actions. So in many ways, they also have the responsibility to change, and they have the capacity to change far greater than somebody living in the low socioeconomic demographic. In that way, there's also an opportunity coming out of this particular study.
In terms of higher levels of education and awareness, it seems like this is only happening up to a certain point. Do you think there's a problem here of people thinking they're making more of an environmental difference than they actually are?
I'd agree it's a big problem, and I know Stuart Barr at Exeter has done quite a few studies on people's behaviours around recycling. Recycling is the last tier in terms of the reduce, reuse, recycle, and it's for good reason. It is more of an end-of-pipe solution. The danger is that people can feel good about recycling and not go any further. With the ecological footprint, it's been very influential as a way of getting a lot of people to think beyond a spatial limit, and that's the problem with recycling. People think about the actions they're doing in their house, and that does have some impact, but the far greater impact is in terms of use of water through their diet or the clothing they buy or whether their house is insulated or their travel indeed. In the United Kingdom, where this particular study was conducted, there's been a lot of development in terms of a lot of the regional airports have got cheaper flights to Europe, and I think that's also contributing to the additional ecological impacts in terms of just the amount of flying that's going on around the world. People travelling basically for the pleasure of travelling, whereas in the past they couldn't afford to.
And in terms of the ecological footprint, would you say that since that concept has been developed and has become more well known, that there is a greater awareness amongst people in terms of those kinds of impacts as opposed to recycling?
Yes, I think the ecological footprint is a technique. I think it's actually been really quite a powerful technique. But as a metaphor, impact is not necessarily the same as the footprint, and there are a few issues about it. But one of the good things that it has done has to get people thinking about the ecological impacts of their actions. Wherever in the world they may occur, asking people to look beyond their local government area or their city or their town or their house and to think about the places you can't see, the need to support your lifestyle on an ongoing basis. And I think that's where it's been really important, is getting away from these very narrow, very fixed, limited boundaries.
You mentioned some issues with the ecological footprint as a metaphor for impact. What are some of the problems with the ecological footprint and how it's been understood?
A way of turning everything into land equivalent. So in the same way that the economic system, market system, turns everything into dollar equivalent or whatever the currency is, the ecological footprint standardises all impacts in terms of the land equivalent. So the amount of land that's required for food, the amount of land that's required to absorb carbon emissions, etc. It assumes that a smaller ecological footprint is a better outcome. And in most cases, it probably is. But to give an example, if a road was proposed to go through a wetland area or through heritage sites or something, so you can reduce your ecological footprint, that's not very good planning from a conservation environmental point of view. You're better off having a larger ecological footprint because the outcome is a better environmental outcome. And one of the main things that ecological footprint people are doing these days is moving into policy formulation. You can actually end up with bad environmental policy if you rely upon the ecological footprint approach and don't have a good understanding of the strengths and limitations.
And do you think there's generally a problem with too much focus being put on initiatives that maybe aren't making that much difference and are then distracting from other methods, and I guess things like greenwashing?
Well, I think it's important that false claims, claims that can't be verified, that sort of thing in terms of greenwashing, as in any other sort of health and safety issues, consumers should be protected against those sort of things. So it is quite complex. It's an area that needs to be, undertaken and further study into. And as much as possible, what we should be doing is designing our cities and towns and our production, consumption systems, etc., to make it easier for people on an everyday basis to be able to live more sustainably.
On that, do you think that more onus needs to be placed on corporations and government initiatives?
I think it's a mixture. I think there's certainly needs for corporations to become more sustainable, and Australian corporations have probably been behind the eight ball a bit on this for some time. Governments are varied, they come and go, and sometimes some more environmentally aware, and also different levels like we've seen in local governments in Australia, but also in places like the United States. I'm thinking here of places like Seattle in Washington have been really important in terms of climate change issues. So local government can make a big difference. And consumers, individual people and community groups, they can make a very big difference. So without putting all the blame and all the responsibility down to individuals and communities, I think there's a role for various levels of society, government, etc., and we should all be playing a part.
And that's Libby King speaking with Dr. Phil McManus.
On Tuesday, it was revealed that the uranium mining company Cameco has just been granted a uranium exploration license for Angela Pamela, a site located just 25 kilometres from the heart of Alice Springs. The federal government's decision has incensed many locals who believe uranium mining could pose a direct threat to the safety of the community and the water supply. Dr. Hilary Tyler from Medical Association for the Prevention of War is at the convergence at Alice Springs protesting against the continued Northern Territory intervention and the impact it's having on the communities there. The Third Degree's James Hitchcock caught her at a rally and spoke with her about the licence approval.
Well, the exploration licence has just been granted.
Yep.
But, of course, the process before mining starts is probably a few years away. I mean, it's a really dirty industry. It's an unnecessary industry. And it's within a water catchment boundary. And Alice Springs is in an arid land. And if we have contamination of our water supply, then Alice Springs Township will cease to exist. I mean, let alone the dust and contamination of dust and within 25 kilometres of our town, it's really not acceptable.
That sounds amazing. Within 25 kilometres of Alice Springs.
That's right.
What are the likely effects on the town or the health effects which this could cause?
Well, the two main environmental contaminations is that of our water supply. Alice Springs water comes from underground aquifers, which have taken 10, 20,000 years to develop. Not only is there the potential for contamination of that aquifer, but also mines use a lot of water, so they'd be using our water. The second contamination of land is of the land itself from dust and radon gas. We have huge dust storms in Alice Springs every now and then, and the potential for long-term exposure to low levels of radiation, which are of a special concern with contamination of land. And there are people who have been living here for a long time and will continue to be living here for a long time. And to expose our children and our children's children to low levels of radiation is totally unacceptable. And then the problems with the health of workers in uranium mines is also something we're concerned about, of course, because uranium miners are, it's expected that there will be excess deaths from cancer with uranium miners.
So who's behind the exploration there at Angela Pamela?
So it's a joint venture between Cameco and Paladin. Cameco opened an office in Alice Springs before the exploration licence was even granted, which was very arrogant, but I suppose showed us, you know, how dodgy the process really has been. They're a huge uranium company. They're based in Canada. There's a place called Port Hope in Canada, which Cameco owns, and which earlier this year it was revealed that there's been contamination of the ground and it's seeping into the harbour, radioactive contamination. So they're quite dodgy.
And that was James Hitchcock speaking with Dr. Hilary Tyler from the Medical Association for the Prevention of War. And over the next few weeks here at the Third Degree, we'll be speaking to people when they return from the Alice Springs Convergence, and we'll be asking them about their experience visiting affected communities. And that's about it for today on the Third Degree.
And we'll see you next time. We'll be right back.